Welcome to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. Well, there are a bunch of presidents that if you're asked to list them in order, that you're going to leave out. People like John Tyler and Millard Fillmore, and some people would even leave out Grover Cleveland, or at least they would leave him out one of the two times that he was president. Chester Arthur, these guys, we have forgotten about them. And so Michael Gerhardt is a professor at the UNC Law School, and he's written a book about the forgotten presidents. Why?
Well, because there are presidents we've forgotten. I think that we talk a lot about the presidency, which makes a lot of sense, and we talk a lot about the Constitution, but we don't talk about all the presidents. We don't always talk about every part of the Constitution. And so I became interested in the fact that there are some presidents that we don't talk about very much, but who did have some impact on constitutional law and on the Constitution more generally. And I thought it might be real interesting to tell the stories of these presidents.
Well, I don't want to just cover you with praise, but it's quite an interesting book. And just for example, the president who is most often overlooked, even if we know his name, William Henry Harrison, the story about him is that he gave a talk, that he gave his inaugural, and caught a cold, caught the flu, caught something, and died a month later, and so was essentially never president. But you've got a whole chapter about his importance as a president in terms of developing the powers of the presidency, the way that things went. How, I mean, in a month, how can you make – why are you right that he was important and everybody else is wrong in saying he was just president for a month? Just forget about it.
Well, one of the points of the book is to suggest that however much time one spends as president can make a difference, that you can spend only about 30 days as president, which is what Harrison had. He had about 31 days at most, and he was, of course, dying throughout much of that. Nevertheless, he had an impact on the Constitution. So I went back and looked at what he did. And if you look particularly at the period of time between the day he was elected president and the day he died, which covers roughly a few months, he really had a—
Back then, longer. You're right. Elected in
early November.
You know, in November, but you don't go in—
You don't
in
take office
until March.
Until early March. That's correct. The Constitution gets amended later to shorten the period between Election Day and when you actually take your oath. But Harrison served at a time when he had a few months in between the day he was elected and the day he took office, which is early March. If you look at that period of time, there's something quite significant that happens that actually has an effect on the presidency and effect on his administration. And the significant thing that happens is he really ends up alienating the leader of the Whig Party in Congress. That turns out to be quite significant because he was the first member of the Whig Party to be elected president. The Whig Party stood for the presidency as a weak institution in relationship to Congress and setting the agenda for the American people and the agenda for the government. Harrison, therefore, was expected to be a weak president. He was expected to defer to Congress, and particularly to the Whig leader in Congress, who was Henry Clay. But over the course of a couple meetings that took place prior to Harrison's taking the oath of office, the two men didn't get along. Harrison did not agree to defer to Clay on setting the agenda for Congress or setting the agenda for the administration. And that meant by the time Harrison took his oath of office, the two men were barely speaking. In fact, 2 weeks into Harrison's presidency, Hay left Washington because he was so disgruntled.
What were they arguing about?
They were arguing about who essentially was going to be in charge of the administration. And Harrison—
Well, Harrison's the president.
And Harrison—
And Clay thinks he's going to pull the strings, or is
right.
that—
Clay thinks he's going to pull the strings or should pull the strings. He thought that was true for his party. In other words, if Harrison really wanted to be a genuine Whig. And also Harrison, Clay felt as a matter of constitutional law, as a matter of the Constitution, he was entitled really to be able to do that. That was the philosophy of their party. But Harrison began to resist that really from the beginning.
Well, now Harrison ran for president as a Whig. He was a general, so I mean, generals are always a little bit of a problem, I guess.
But not a great general. But you're right.
Well, he gave order. He was used to being in charge, I guess.
That's right.
And that, Well, go ahead.
So you're right, and that may tell us something about Harrison. But again, that's something a lot of people miss about Harrison, that he might have been somebody who would prefer to be in charge. But that's not what he had pledged when he ran. When he ran, he said, "Oh, I'll be a good Whig, and I'll do what the Whigs want." But I think once he began to realize he was going to be president, it began to dawn on him that that meant he had the responsibility for protecting the prerogatives of the office, and that was a really serious realization on his part. And once Clay realized that Harrison had begun to realize this aspect of the office, Clay got unhappy. Clay got angry. And the two men again ended up not speaking. So 2 weeks into Harrison's presidency, Clay leaves town, leaving Harrison in effect in charge of the government, which is a very important moment in constitutional law.
Well, let me ask you this. Harrison is after Martin Van Buren, but there's a whole history of strong presidents, at least in my mind. George right. Washington was a strong president, wasn't he? And Jefferson turned out, although he had some reservations about the strong federal government, he turned out to be pretty strong. Andrew Jackson was another general who was used to getting his way. Weren't the prerogatives of the presidency established so that—
They were not fully established by the time Harrison took office. And as you point out, Jackson, in fact, was a very strong president, but his great political nemesis was Henry Clay.
So the Whigs were in Henry Clay, they were saying, we don't want people like Jackson
right.
being president. We
That's
want
right.
the legislature to run things.
That's right. That's exactly right. So we want Congress to run things. We don't like the idea of having a strong president. And most historians will tell you that between Jackson and Lincoln, there were no strong presidents. But part of the point of this book is to suggest that that's actually not true. It's part of the story of William Henry Harrison and other presidents that we've forgotten, that they actually turn out to be stronger than we expect. And Congress has to react to that. And they have a battle, Congress and the president battle for supremacy essentially over the federal government, where Harrison starts this battle and in some ways. And so he resists Clay's efforts to take over the administration. And the Whigs also had believed, and Clay also had believed, that the president should defer to his cabinet. But Harrison resists that as well. And that helps establish the relationship between the presidents and their cabinet.
Was it a custom? You point this out very nicely in the book that the Whigs expected Harrison to follow the lead of his, when not following the lead of the legislature, that he was in essence sort of a captive of his cabinet. He was like a one of these mayors who has only one vote on the city council.
Right.
That if the cabinet voted to go one way, the president had to follow that lead. Was that the way the prior presidents had worked?
The prior presidents had essentially not settled a practice on this, although they generally tried to take the lead in organizing their cabinet and in directing what the cabinet should do. But there was no settled practice. And so that gave the Whigs, they thought, the opportunity to direct Harrison to follow the cabinet's will. And so the Whig philosophy was that the president only got a vote if the cabinet tied over any particular policy, including the decision on which person to nominate to a particular office. Once Harrison got into office, once he took the oath, and it settled, or he began to realize that he was the president. In fact, at one point, he even tells Clay, "You forget I'm president." And I think that really shows something was occurring to Harrison. And there's a moment when he's sitting in a cabinet meeting, and the cabinet is essentially telling him, "This is the person you should appoint to a particular office." Harrison scribbles on a piece of paper and gives it to Daniel Webster, Secretary of State, and tells Webster to read it. And the piece of paper, which we still have, says that I, William Henry Harrison, and the D, insert your expletive there, President of the United States, and I'll nominate this person to this office.
Well, this is the idea we have of this president in bed dying, and he's actually meeting with his cabinet and telling his cabinet that he's in charge. They're
right.
not.
He's trying to be president. So he's setting important precedents which are going to influence the office and influence the relationship between the presidency and Congress at that period of time.
He's dismissed as a president, as we mentioned earlier, because he was only there for 30 days. So do all of these strong things that he did, does it, in your mind, if you have to rate the president, does it keep him from being last on the list?
It might keep him from being last, although I don't rate presidents in the book. I mean, the part of the point of the book is not to rate them or evaluate them or say whether they're good or bad, or just to sort of – it's more to measure their impact, to say, okay, these people served and had some influence over the shape of the office.
Following that, is he the least impactful?
That's a very good question. It could be that he might be the least impactful, but that doesn't mean he had no impact. Which is the general conclusion of most people. Although, again, it's hard to measure the exact impact. We did try to come up with some rough calculation of that just for fun at the end of the book, and we concluded that he might sort of be second or so to last in terms of his actual impact on the office. But that still means there's something we could learn from what he did as president.
We're visiting with Michael Gerhart. He's a law professor at the Carolina Law School, and also the author of a new book, The Forgotten Presidents. He and I will be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. I'm visiting with Michael Gerhart. If you joined us late, he's a professor at the Carolina Law School, and he's also the author of The Forgotten Presidents, Their Untold Constitutional Legacy. You approach this as a scholar of the Constitution, as a law teacher who's fascinated with the Constitution and its history. Is this really a constitutional history? Is that what you...
It is a constitutional history, but it's the some of the history of the Constitution that we generally don't know about or that we dismiss as being particularly important. Much of what I do as a constitutional law professor is focus on the relationship between Congress and the president. When we focus on that relationship, we usually think of great presidents, people like Abraham Lincoln or George Washington, more recently perhaps Franklin Roosevelt or even Ronald Reagan. But the point of the book, again, is to focus on the impact of some people on the Constitution that we forget. And I'm suggesting that there's an impact worth remembering.
One of the presidents who's I've been interested in is Grover Cleveland. I don't think he's forgotten because everybody says he's the one who lost his reelection bid and then came back 4 years later and won again. So I have a hard time agreeing with you that he's forgotten. But you had a point there. Let me say this and then you correct me.
Sure.
Is that you say he's forgotten because although he's noted for that one thing, that otherwise nobody remembers anything that he did. And you say that he did have a pretty big impact. Sort of the reason?
So I think he had a much greater impact than people might think. You might be right. There may be some folks out there that remember he's the only president who's served two non-consecutive terms. But it may well be that some folks don't even remember that. But even if you remember that one trivial fact, although it may not be so trivial, there's a lot he did in 8 years as president. And so that's what I'm trying to restore to our story of the presidency.
I remember him for another reason. Excuse me for breaking in, but there was a ditty, a haw, haw, where's your paw, or something gone to the White House, haw, haw. So there was something, a little scandal.
Right. Well, in fact, it sort of was funny because when he ran for the presidency, the first time he ran against James Blaine, who was really quite a notable figure, much better known at the time. People thought Blaine would sort of win the White House. But the election turned out to be sort of an odd contest between this little known sort of governor of New York, Grover Cleveland, and Blaine, this big figure. But the controversy was ironic. Blaine was thought to be this great public servant, but it turned out there were some problems when he was in government. Cleveland turned out to have maybe some personal problems. He had actually fathered somebody outside of wedlock. But while he was in office, he was a man of great integrity. So when the American people made a choice, they chose the person who actually was an honest public servant rather than Blaine, although somebody who did a lot in office, perhaps less than always an honest public servant. It turned out that Cleveland was a very honest president for 8 years, a very strong president for 8 years, set a record at least at the time for the most vetoes in office, which was an extraordinary thing for the president to do. He's the only Democrat to serve in the latter half of the 20th century, but he became the model for Woodrow Wilson, who had, as a political scientist, early in the 20th century, thought that there were no strong presidents in the latter half of the 19th century, but then he revised that calculation and ended up modeling himself on Cleveland. And most of us remember Wilson as president.
So, the gosh, that you introduced a lot of things that would be fun to talk about. You mentioned about vetoes. And a veto of a bill now is pretty, at least in the most recent years, pretty rare. It's not an everyday kind of thing.
Right.
Two or three a year or something, maybe at most. And these are hundreds that grow.
Literally hundreds. Yeah.
And what's this all about? I mean, that can't be, there can't be, you can't even imagine Congress passing hundreds of bills now these days.
Right. So this, again, is a sort of a real contest, although we've kind of swept it under the rug of history, so to speak, but there's a lot to talk about. So Congress at the time is trying to pass a number of pieces of legislation, many of which have to do with trying to provide some support for people of one kind or another, some, for example, for disaster relief, and others for some public support, veterans of the war.
Among these hundreds, there were a lot of bills to provide relief for one person or one family
But these were people. In fact, most of the relief that was provided was for people that served in the Civil War, and they were veterans. And Congress was trying to provide some veteran support. But Cleveland vetoes all of this, remarkably. And it was all so with a couple things going on. One was Cleveland's belief that the federal government shouldn't provide special interest support, and the other was the fact that he was strengthening the presidency in its relationship to Congress. Now, today you might hear a lot of people say the federal government should support people, but so one of their models might well turn out to be Grover Cleveland.
He's a Democratic president. He was more in line with the philosophy that
some conservatives today.
Limited government.
Right. Right. So he did believe in limited government. He did believe the federal government didn't have an obligation to support some people, even if they were veterans, which was a remarkable thing. So he was a man as good as his word, stood his ground, went to battle with Congress over that and over a number of nominations as well. Shaped the presidency further when he went to battle over something called the Tenure in Office Act, which was an act the Congress had passed a while before to restrict presidential nominating authority, the authority of the president to nominate some folks and even to remove them in order to create vacancies to fill. But Cleveland went to battle over that piece of legislation remarkably and really helped kill it, and other presidents then followed his lead.
It's interesting to me. This is sort of a timely discussion topic in North Carolina, where the new governor faces a situation in which the offices, the political offices and other offices are stacked with people who've been appointed by Democrats, and he wants to clean house, and everybody's complaining about this. This was a battle that you described that was fought almost all the way through your book of presidents who wanted appointed power, and people said, no, that's the president's to manage. He's not to come in and clean house.
Right. So there are some things we take for granted today, that the president might be able to fire somebody who's serving in the executive branch. That wasn't always settled. In fact, there was a big open question under the Constitution throughout much of the 19th century. But Cleveland had a definitive answer, which was the president could fill any office in the executive branch he wanted to.
And did that settle it?
It helped to settle, at least insofar as the presidency was concerned. And even Congress sort of backed down to some extent, which was remarkable if you think about it. Eventually, the Supreme Court of the United States weighed in early in the 20th century when there was somebody named Woodrow Wilson as president. Wilson tried to do the same thing. It got challenged, went to the Supreme Court of the United States. The Supreme Court sided with Wilson, and that became an important Supreme Court precedent. And now all three branches have sort of agreed. The president can fire somebody in the executive branch if he wants to and fill that office with somebody he prefers instead.
Well, an interesting sidelight, and I'd love for you to talk about this if you would. We're talking about Grover Cleveland, and now you're talking about Woodrow Wilson. And apparently Woodrow Wilson, who was interested in this congressional governance that mm-hmm. you describe so well in your book and the challenges to it by these presidents, including the forgotten presidents— that Wilson, you said a minute ago that Wilson, that he thought Cleveland was his model and his hero. Now, how did Cleveland feel about Wilson?
Well, actually, the two men hated each other. That's one of the great ironies. So after Cleveland left the presidency, he decided to retire to a place called Princeton, New Jersey. And then he became involved with that great university there, Princeton. Turns out the president of Princeton at the time was a man named Woodrow Wilson. So Cleveland finds himself on the board of trustees of Princeton, and Wilson's the president of Princeton, and so then they clashed. more than once during that period. Wilson was making certain decisions as president of Princeton. Eventually, he clashed with the dean of the graduate school in a decision that might seem to be completely trivial over where to locate the graduate school of Princeton. Wilson lost that battle.
And then, can we remember which one wanted it where?
They wanted roughly in the center of campus.
Both of them did.
Cleveland
wanted it in the center of campus.
Well, Cleveland sided with the forces that wanted it more toward the center.
Uh-huh.
Wilson didn't like that. But he lost that battle. And the unfortunate thing about that is, so Wilson sort of basically quit. He's quit the presidency of Princeton thinking, okay, I'll go on to do something else. What was the something else? He became governor of New Jersey. And the rest, as they say, is history. So then after being governor of New Jersey, he decided to become president for 8 years. And you know, we know a lot happened during that time period, including World War I. So it would have been interesting to wonder what might have happened had he not clashed with Cleveland and stayed as president of Princeton.
Well, we're visiting with Michael Gearhart, a law professor at University of North Carolina and the author of a new book, The Forgotten Presidents. He and I'll be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. I'm visiting with Michael Gearhart. He is the author of a new book, The Forgotten Presidents, Their Untold Constitutional Legacy. And Michael Gearhart's day job is teaching law at the University of North Carolina. Just as an aside, how in the world do you have time to this is a book in which you deal with 12 forgotten presidents. Is that right? 12
right.
or so
right.
forgotten presidents. And you're having to teach and do your law research?
Well, so I'm happy or proud to say it's my fifth book, but it was a lot of fun to write. It's one of the things I do. And, of course, I love to teach constitutional law at UNC as well. But it's just one of those things I work on here and there. And as time went on and got it done. Teaching law sometimes teaches you a lot about the law, and it teaches you a lot about the presidency if you happen to teach constitutional law like I do. So those things. So learning about constitutional law as I teach it it helps me write about it. So in a way, these are all different labors of love.
Well, the main man around here at WCHL is Anthony Wellman, and he told me that looked at the cover of your book and saw Millard Fillmore's picture. He said, I know about him. This is my fifth grade report. And I said, I think you're probably the only other person other than Michael Gearhart who's written much about Millard Fillmore. We say that name and we don't even – I mean, we pay no attention to it. It's even like we think of it, it's like this Mallard Fillmore in the comic books, right. the right-wing comic strip that we like to read. But you made me think he's really special. I mean, it turned out
he did have an impact. There aren't many folks that remember Fillmore at all.
Give us a little background.
He was the sort of vice president for a man named Zachary Taylor. Taylor died 15 minutes into the presidency. And then suddenly Fillmore had been sort of on the outs at that point.
These were, we've forgotten about the Whig Party, but this was sort of the second team of Whigs
right.
that were
That's right.
elected.
And Fillmore comes in as the first president who might have been a genuine Whig.
He really believed that the president should be subservient to Congress.
Well, in some respects, yeah. So even he has a little bit of a change of heart, which turns out to have a huge impact. So he does believe the president should defer to Congress on various things. So one of the first things he does, which Taylor had refused to do, but he died and didn't have a chance to follow through on what he wanted. So Fillmore agrees, in the absence of Taylor, to sign into law something called the Compromise of 1850. It included a very controversial piece of law called the Fugitive Slave Act. So Congress is happy. But it turns out that there were a number of northern states that were not happy.
Give us a little background. This is really we're approaching the Civil War and the disenchantment of the South threatening at every moment to leave or to try
right.
to succeed. And the one of the pieces that the Congress throws at them is to say, okay, we'll put the federal government at your service to get your slaves right. back if they run away and escape to the North.
Right, that's exactly right. So if some Southern slaves escape going to the North, it becomes the responsibility for officials within the particularly federal officials, of course, to find those slaves and then to send them back. But Northern states didn't want to help that. Northern states really hated this law. So, in fact, they filed a petition that vowed that they wanted to nullify the law. It's rather ironic because there was the nullification doctrine, which was very popular throughout the South. So suddenly Fillmore finds himself enforcing federal law against these states that don't want to follow it. That might sound very familiar.
Well, it's a problem for him because the Whig, although there were Southern Whigs, the Whig's strength, and at this point more and more was an is an many of its people, like Abraham Lincoln, I guess, were anti-slavery,
right,
or at least anti-expansion.
Right. Well, this is going to so Fillmore's effort to enforce this federal law in places that people didn't want to enforce it, particularly the North, turned out to be quite controversial. And Fillmore goes around throughout the North vowing to enforce federal law. He puts all the power of the federal government behind this law. It's very controversial. But he weaves this theory about why states that don't like federal law still have to follow it. And if necessary, he was going to use federal force to ensure that these states followed federal law. So the theory that he's weaving together was going to influence a very young Whig at the time, a guy named Abraham Lincoln.
And Lincoln, so this is kind of interesting, at least to me. So he's enforcing this. You got to do what the Congress of the United States says, even if your state doesn't like it.
Right.
But he's saying this to the northern states who are anti-slavery and don't want to track down slaves and send them back to the South. But his secret message is to the South that you better watch this because we'll do the same thing to you. Is that sort of what he's saying?
Well, I don't know that he might not fully appreciate all of that, although I think there's a good chance he did. Because at the same time, Texas was threatening to invade New Mexico to keep it from becoming a state. And Fillmore—
Texas, at this point in time, is it a state?
It's a state and it's a pro-slavery state. Didn't want New Mexico to become a state because it would have been an anti-slavery state. Texas figures one way to stop that is to go back and take back some of its territory it thought was its. And it threatened to invade New Mexico to take it over. Well, Fillmore says, well, no, you can't do that either. If necessary, we'll send down the federal government, you know, the army, marshals, whatever we got to do to stop it. So at one end or another, Fillmore is really threatening to use federal force to put down an effort to invade federal territory, New Mexico, or to keep states in the North to follow federal law. Either way you look at it, he's really fashioning a philosophy that's going to be followed by Lincoln when he takes office, and Lincoln's going to follow Fillmore's precedents in a much more dramatic way during the Civil War.
So your argument, I guess Fillmore would be at the bottom, towards the bottom of anybody's list of ratings of presidents, and you're saying, this guy's important.
Well, he's important in a way we just hadn't appreciated or we've forgotten, but he was important to Lincoln. Lincoln's watching and learning, and Lincoln's going to use everything he learns from Fillmore and from Taylor as well, who had preceded Fillmore. In fact, later he says Taylor was my model when I became president.
Well, let's back up. Talk about Taylor then. Taylor is another general who was elected.
Right.
The Whigs used used generals to win elections.
Right.
And then
the problem is they were still generals, or thought like generals.
I'll tell you what. I mean, the things that I remember about Zachary Taylor is mostly, I mean, we got a big statue of James K. Polk in the rotunda or somewhere in the Moorhead Building as our Carolina's president, and I just remember that Polk and Zachary Taylor
didn't like
each other too much. And Polk was suspicious. Zachary Taylor, I guess, was a general in the Mexican War, that he was using that to foster his political ambitions.
Right.
So who was Zachary Taylor?
As you point out, a general, and he actually was a very beloved general. And one of the great victories he had was during the Mexican War, which helped us to secure the territory that we now know as Texas. Being the popular general as a result of the Mexican War enabled him to win the presidency in his own right. And then he became a very strong president, much to the chagrin or to
sorrow. All right, again, if anybody joined us late, what I learned from you was that the Whigs really didn't want strong presidents. They wanted strong Congresses, but they kept electing generals who wanted to be strong presidents.
So once again, we have a Whig in this fashion. It was Zachary Taylor who said to Congress, no, you're going to follow what I want. And he wanted to admit two states to the Union that were going to be anti-slavery. Whigs in Congress didn't want to follow what he preferred. And of course, Southerners didn't want that either. So there's this tremendous standstill for 15 months. Nothing much is happening while Taylor's president. Ms. Taylor still tells Congress, you should follow what I say. Congress isn't doing what he wants. It didn't want to fill even the offices to which he was nominating people. So he made a record number of recess appointments. At the same time, he's saying—
For those who aren't following this, what is a recess appointment?
So that's an appointment the president can make if Congress hasn't filled, or particularly the Senate, hasn't confirmed somebody he wants to fill a federal office by the time it goes into recess. Taylor figures, okay, fine. I'll fill all these offices. It doesn't even matter if we're in a recess. I'll fill them if Congress hasn't agreed to confirm the person I want to the office. And he makes over 400 recess appointments. Very strong thing for presidents to do. Sets a really important precedent that even influences presidents to this day. So this is really repeatedly beating up the Whig philosophy of the presidency, at the same time strengthening the presidency, again, influencing others to understand what the presidency can do. And, of course, that young Whig, Abraham Lincoln's watching and learning about the strength of the presidency. Fillmore's the vice president. He's watching and learning as well. He's going to later agree to some extent to be a strong president. And these strong presidencies end up being really important for Lincoln.
Help me with this in explaining what I'm going to try to do, and that is that that the Whigs, while they believe that the Congress should be give the direction, they also were not saying that when there was a matter of emergency or when there was something that required strong action, the president, consistent with the directions of Congress, had the responsibility to be strong.
Yeah, that's the case. I think Whigs hadn't fully thought it out, and so they were really just wanted a weak president. The difficulty is the Constitution doesn't necessarily set up a weak presidency. So these folks would come into office, take an oath, and then they would fulfill the oath, much to the sorrow of Whigs.
The oath. What about the oath required
to support and defend the Constitution?
So the Whig president who runs on a Whig platform of a Whig president, he gets up there and takes that oath, and it says to defend the Constitution. I'm responsible for that.
Right, but he's also responsible for enforcing the law. That's his particular charge. So then the question becomes, how does he go about enforcing the law? That's what Millard Fillmore did. He enforced a very bad law, we would think. It was called the Fugitive Slave Act, but he enforced it to the hilt and used federal power to do that. Again, that became a useful precedent for Lincoln to enforce federal law against the southern states that didn't want to follow it.
Well, just to get the history straight, the Fugitive Slave Law was part of a larger compromise.
Right.
And so Fillmore would probably say, I don't like this part of it, but I like what I got, and the northerners should like what they got.
Right.
I can't remember what it was, the admission of California. Or
well, there were five different bills, but they all were just a compromise. And Fillmore signs it into law, and he signed it into law because Congress wanted it. He also had a belief at the time that besides that, it might help avert civil war.
That the overall package of laws.
Right.
Well, as you can tell, I'm excited about your book.
Well, I appreciate
talking to Michael Gerhardt about his book, The Forgotten Presidents. We're going to take a short break, and he and I will be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. Michael Gerhardt is a professor, a law professor at the University of North Carolina School of Law, and is the author of The Forgotten Presidents, Their Untold Constitutional Legacy, an important and fascinating book. And so I've picked out the presidents that I wanted to talk about. In the remaining short time, I mean, if you have to pick one of these guys to talk about to illustrate the points that you make in your book about how every president has been important in developing the powers of the presidency, who would you pick today?
Well, there are a lot to talk about, and I appreciate the chance to do it. It's a fun thing to consider, an important thing to consider. So why don't we think about Calvin Coolidge a little bit? So Calvin Coolidge was a person who didn't believe the federal government should necessarily have a lot of power to enact laws. And so he liked the idea of a smaller federal government. But he turned out to be a pretty strong president, too. And he ended up agreeing to do certain things, such as being the first president to sign into law the federal regulation of airplanes. something now we take for granted. He also signed into law the first federal regulation of broadcasting, which again is a very common thing. These are all things we do today, but yet they were signed into law by a guy who didn't believe in a strong federal government. He also ended up thinking foreign affairs is pretty important. And so he became part of an effort to create something called the World Court, which again, still exists. Another one of his initiatives didn't work so well. He helped put together a treaty that was going to outlaw war, and that fell apart. He also didn't believe the federal government should come to the aid of the economy if it was failing. That was a problem. And later we had the Great Depression, which in some respects proved him wrong and really destroyed his legacy.
Well, proved him wrong in the ideas of those of us who are Keynesians or, right. or who believe that the way to solve government or the way to solve a nation's economic collapse is by vigorous action
right.
and expenditures by the federal government. But I've got a friend who's written a great book about Coolidge who right. argues that if the country had just followed what Coolidge would have done, which is nothing essentially, that the country would have after a painful readjustment, that the market system would have adjusted and that we would have come back stronger than we would under the Keynesian aspects. He said, you know, it didn't. None of that Franklin Roosevelt stuff worked. It was just the war that. And the passage of time. In other words, I guess, as you point out in your book, even though you say he's a forgotten president, that Ronald Reagan put
right.
you tell us Ronald Reagan put his picture back up on the White House. So there are people who still believe.
Right. And then after Reagan, the next president sent it back down to the basement. so it goes back. It goes up and down. And that's Coolidge's legacy. But my field is the Constitution, not so much politics.
Gotcha.
And the Constitution allows for a president to sign laws he thinks are constitutional into effect. Coolidge did that. Some of these laws actually fortified the strength or made the federal government stronger, which was, again, a valuable lesson to remember. And the Constitution also allows the president to sign laws into effect that might support the economy or might provide some activity or some regulations that would make the economy stronger. So the next president after Coolidge was Herbert Hoover. He too thought, well, let's not do all that much to help this ailing economy. So we had two presidents in a row, Coolidge and Hoover, that thought that. American people weren't so happy. So they elected a president named Franklin Roosevelt who thought differently. And then he tried to sort of recharge the economy. And there's some suggestions that they actually did help. But of course, he had a lot to deal with, including a war in Europe and maybe another war that was coming from the other direction as well. So all the activities that Roosevelt undertook helped bring the federal government back into power, really made it stronger. And that was the legacy of Roosevelt, which helped to bury the Coolidge legacy.
Wow. Well, Coolidge, you mentioned, I think some of us also would be surprised that you picked Jimmy Carter as one of the forgotten presidents. You say... Maybe he's not forgotten now, but I think in the future he will be forgotten, so I'm going to include right. him. Why? How did you get to that? You just needed one more president.
Well, I could have stopped, I guess, at any time. But I thought it was maybe worth being a little more controversial and interesting to make some predictive judgments. And one of my predictions, as you say, was to predict that if we don't think about it very much, in time, Carter might well be forgotten. And Carter's 4 years are already being forgotten. I think to a large extent, there are not many people out there who weren't alive at the time who could probably tell us what Carter did, except maybe they might think he was a complete failure. It turns out, over the course of 4 years, while the economy was hurting and he was trying to help it, there were other things that Carter was doing that were signing laws into effect that now are pretty common. So he was strengthening federal regulation in the environment. He wanted a national energy policy. Didn't quite get all that into effect that he wanted. He was diversifying the federal judiciary, which is something that we now take for granted or continue to try to do. So most of the initiatives that Carter wanted to go into effect actually became law. And that was part of his legacy that we don't remember. There are other things he did that we might remember but forget to attach to him. One was the support of affirmative action. He put a lot of the federal government power behind that, and now the Democratic Party is aligned with affirmative action in a way that we now take for granted. He also for better or worse, put the Democratic Party on the side of abortion rights. And that, too, became the legacy of the Democratic Wow. Party, and it's part of the law of the land today.
Well, you persuaded me. And you persuaded me that these forgotten presidents are and have been very important in the development of our constitutional history and the division of powers between the three branches of government. And I thank you, Michael Gearhart, for your book, The Forgotten Presidents, and for sharing some of that with us here today.
Thanks. It's been a lot of fun. I appreciate it.
And thanks to you for listening. This is D.G. Martin, who's talking. I'll be back here before you know it.